Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for today, Tuesday, November the 14th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, All Eyes on AI, CV Educators Using AI to Increase Time Spent Helping Students. It's written by Maria Cooper. Jonana Nanke normally takes 6 hours to create a lesson plan for her American literature class, but now she can do it with the click of a mouse. The West High School English teacher started utilizing artificial intelligence as her personal secretary this year. AI helps her with drafting emails, writing individual educational plans, creating rubrics, and matching students to appropriate reading levels. Many teachers in the area are delving into the world of AI in hopes of implementing it in their classrooms. Ann Thomas, the media and library consultant for Central Rivers Area Education Agency, is taking the reins on teaching educators about the technology. She began holding professional development meetings about AI earlier this year after ChatGPT's 2022 launch. She booked up every day through the end of January doing presentations. It got really good, really fast last November, she said. Schools and education were kind of caught without knowing quite what to do. She said it is important for school districts to not ban AI because it's here and it's not going to go away, and students need to be taught how to use it ethically. Kim Ross, a chemistry and physics teacher at Waverly Shellrock High School, is one of those educators taking the initiative to inform her students on how and when to use AI. She became interested after learning about it from her daughter and eventually took summer classes on the topic, earning a credential through Drake University. She also attended a virtual conference on AI. She uses the technology to help with lesson planning, create worksheets and problems, write scientific procedures, and proofread her work. She also encourages her 11th grade chemistry students to utilize ChatGPT to help check their work and provide them with extra practice problems. For students to get the best and most accurate results, she teaches them how to write good prompts or what to input into the program. In one of her recent lessons, Ross required students to use the tool to check their claims and evidence when doing lab reports. A claim is a statement that answers a question, and evidence is scientific data that supports that claim. Junior Nolan Foster said it was unexpected when Ross told students at the beginning of the year that she was going to experiment with AI in the class. I was really surprised when she asked us to use it, he said. I've had about 5 teachers not let us use it. Foster puts his lab reports into ChatGPT to make them better, as well as ask for extra practice problems. He likes AI because someone else doesn't need to be present to assist him. It helps because Mrs. Ross is one person, he said. She can use it as another teacher. Nanke said having an assistant in her classroom is helping her be a better teacher. This time last year, I was just really struggling, she said. AI gave me a second wind to my education. She said prior to AI helping her write emails, newsletters, and rubrics, most of her time would be spent at the computer. Now she is spending time in the class, actually with my kids, and is a more effective teacher. AI not only gives Nanke extra time helping students, it also helps her come up with new projects and homework ideas. She tells students to use AI to help when they are struggling with things like creating a thesis statement or essay outline, but only as a jumping-off point. She said students can use the technology to help them write rough drafts, something she doesn't always have time for. AI invigorated my enthusiasm for what I do and takes some of the stress away, that mental load that we have of managing 140 children a day, she said. This just really lets me focus on what is important, and that's working with my kids. However, not all educators have been immediately keen on using AI. Thomas said many teachers and administrators are worried about plagiarism and cheating. Technically, she noted, using AI to write something for you is not plagiarism. According to the law, plagiarism involves writing created by a human. The content created from AI is owned by the person who inputs the prompt. Thomas said some districts are looking at reworking their plagiarism policies to deal with academic dishonesty. Both she and Ross said cheating is not a new concept. Using AI to cheat is just another way to do it and is bound to happen, whether teachers allow using AI or not. I feel like I want the idea of using AI to be a way out in the open and then have a discussion, Ross said. There are kids that legitimately don't think there is wrong information. In teaching about AI, whether to other educators or students, Ross and Thomas touch on bias and hallucinations. AI bias is an anomaly that comes from the program due to prejudiced assumptions made during the development of algorithms. Hallucinations are a response that includes false information. I certainly don't think AI is anything that schools should be putting behind a firewall, Thomas said. This is going to be on the computers at home. They need to understand how to use it and use it ethically. Another reason teachers are wary of using AI is because they are afraid it may take their jobs. But pro-AI educators say that isn't possible. This does not do your job for you, Nanke said. You could just throw anybody in these rooms with these kids. You couldn't just throw anybody in these rooms with these kids. My philosophy is that it's a tool, Ross said, and with any tool, it doesn't replace anybody. You have to learn to use that tool correctly. Ross also said everyone needs to learn about, or at least be aware of, the technology. She thinks there will eventually be legislation that could regulate AI. In turn, teaching students about the pros and cons of AI could help them be more informed in the future. You can draw your own conclusions about whether AI is good or bad, but it's here, she said. It's going to become part of your life, and you need to know what you're okay with and what you're not. Next is an article entitled, Voters Like Moderates in Elections for Schools. Republicans Push Back on Conclusions from Election. This is written by Aaron Murphy from the Courier Des Moines Bureau. In 2021, school board elections in Iowa and across the country swung toward candidates who opposed pandemic-era restrictions on schools, including closures and mask mandates. 2 years later, that pendulum swung in the opposite direction as candidates who supported restrictions on school materials and classroom discussions about gender and transgender students were roundly defeated earlier this week in school board elections in Iowa and in the nation. School board elections in the Mason City, Lynn Mar, Ankeny, and Johnston school districts in Iowa, just to name a few, went almost exclusively for candidates who were supported by the teachers' union and who opposed those book policing and transgender student policies. Almost exclusively, candidates who were endorsed by conservative groups, including the self-described Parents' Right Advocacy group Moms for Liberty, failed. While Iowa Republicans caution against drawing broad conclusions about conservative K-12 education policies from last Tuesday's elections, experts said the results spoke clearly. I think the only way to read the school board elections from Tuesday is a repudiation of Moms for Liberty. They were defeated pretty handily just about everywhere, said David Anderson, a political science professor at Iowa State University. And it suggests to me that Iowans have had their fill of the culture wars being brought to our schools. School board elections in Iowa are nonpartisan affairs. The candidates who run for the unpaid positions do not declare allegiance to a political party. In practice, however, many school board elections in recent years have featured the political divides of Democrat versus Republican or liberal versus conservative that are common to other areas of government. And increasingly, political groups and issue advocacy organizations are engaging in school board elections. Among the litany of school board elections across Iowa were conservative-leaning candidates were nearly or entirely swept. In Lynn Mar, where a policy no longer enforced included a gender support plan for students, drew the ire of Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and even Republican former Vice President Mike Pence during his since-halted presidential campaign, voters reelected two incumbents while none of the three candidates endorsed by Moms for Liberty was elected to the four open board seats. In Ankeny, where backlash to pandemic-era school closures brought in a wave of conservative candidates 2 years ago, including one endorsed by Reynolds, in a rare move by a sitting governor to endorse in a school board election, voters elected four progressive candidates. Only one of the candidates, supported by Republican fundraising, won one of the Ankeny board's five open seats. In Johnston, where a debate exploded over an effort to form a student chapter of Turning Point USA, a right-wing group with history of Christian nationalism, four candidates endorsed or supported by Moms for Liberty and other conservative groups failed to win any of the four open seats. Instead, four progressive candidates, two incumbents, and two newcomers earned the votes. In Mason City, the KLMN slate of four candidates endorsed by the Mason City Education Association Union representing teachers in the district defeated four other candidates who emphasized parental involvement, social issues, curriculum, and library book restrictions. One of those candidates had read information provided by Moms for Liberty at public meetings. There were similar results throughout Iowa. In Cedar Rapids, the same electorate that resoundingly rejected the school district's $220 million bond referendum also reelected three out of four incumbents, while two Moms for Liberty endorsed candidates were defeated. In Carroll County, which went for Republican President Donald Trump by 63% in the year 2020, three candidates supported by a Republican state legislator failed to win any of the three open seats. Results of Tuesday's elections demonstrate that voters spoke loudly and clearly about who they want to make crucial decisions affecting all students and educators in their local communities. Mike Baranek, president of the statewide teachers union, the Iowa State Education Association, said in a statement. Baranek said more than 85% of union-endorsed candidates won school board seats in the elections. And equally important, we saw the total defeat in the districts where we engaged the Moms for Liberty candidates and their divisive agenda representing a vocal minority, Baranek said in the statement. Moms for Liberty, which has chapters across the country, emerged on the political scene in the year 2021 as some parents pushed back against pandemic restrictions in public schools. The group has since expanded to opposing books and curriculum that reference race and gender identity and transgender-affirming school policies. The organization has drawn backlash for spreading anti-LGBTQ ideas and stripping libraries and classrooms of diverse material. The Southern Poverty Law Center, a civil rights watchdog, this year identified the nationwide nonprofit as an extremist group. In an emailed statement, the leader of the Linn County chapter of Moms for Liberty, Geraldine Jones, said the organization is not angry with the election's results and welcomed the candidates who were elected. Make no mistake, we are not angry with the results of the election. We supported parents when they stepped into this ring of fire, and we will continue to support the parents, teachers, students, and community members alike in years ahead, Jones said. It is my hope that one day a bridge will be built in our community, one that doesn't require reaching deep into the pockets of our taxpayers. In her statement, Jones also said Moms for Liberty members experienced hatefulness during the campaign and accused the news media of not displaying neutrality or reporting truth. It saddens me to be on the receiving end of this hateful divide in our community, Jones said. Our chapter has experienced nothing but hatefulness this whole election, telling us that moms, dads, and grandparents are unwanted in our community and to leave the district because our beliefs, yet we're the ones being labeled an extremist hate group. One Iowa Action, the political arm of an advocacy group for LGBTQ individuals, said 85% of the school board candidates in Iowa that it endorsed won a seat. Iowa voters told us that what we've always known. We know that book bans and censorship violate the principles of free speech. We know that extreme positions targeting children for exclusion and bullying are unacceptable. Most importantly, we know that kids deserve a safe, inclusive learning environment regardless of who they are or where they come from, Courtney Rays, executive director for One Iowa Action, said in a statement. That's what this election was about, and that's the undeniable message that they sent to politicians across our state and across the country. New state laws passed earlier this year in Iowa with only Republican support, require the removal of any books or curriculum that describe sex acts, prohibit the teaching of sexual orientation or gender identity through sixth grade, and prohibit transgender K through 12 students from using bathrooms that align with their gender identity. State House Republicans insist Tuesday's election results are not a rejection of those policies. They point to Republicans' recent resounding victories in Iowa's general elections and some public polling that shows a majority of Iowans agree with some of those policies. Iowa Republicans also suggest the results do not speak to any larger issues because far fewer people vote in school board elections. Melissa Deitch, a spokeswoman for the Republican legislators in the Iowa House, called such a conclusion quite an oversimplification of Iowa's positions on K-12 policies. Iowa House Republicans have been running on a pro-parent agenda for years, and we expanded our majority in both the 2020 and 2022 elections, Deitch said. I don't think you can claim that Iowans have suddenly changed their minds about using a handful of races in the Des Moines Metro, Cedar Rapids, and Iowa City in a low turnout election. These are areas where liberals were already winning. A majority of Iowans say public schools should not teach about gender identity or sexual orientation through sixth grade, according to a Des Moines Register/Mediacom Iowa poll published in March. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Marion Republican whose children attend school in the Linmar district, also pushed back at the conclusion that Tuesday's election results were a rejection of those new K-12 policies. Hinson added that as a parent in the Linmar district, I'll be watching the school board very closely. Let me be very clear. I support our public school system. I'm a product of public schools. My mom was a public school teacher, Hinson told the Gazette. What I've been very clear on is that it's critical that parents are empowered and that they're involved when it comes to their children's education. Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman issued a statement also pointing to the party's recent electoral success in the legislature, governor's office, and Congress. Iowa's had a Republican governor since the year 2011, majorities in both chambers of the legislature since 2017, and currently occupies all six seats in the state's congressional delegation. Iowa's Democrats shouldn't get giddy spinning yesterday's results. They are still a super minority in this state and will be as long as they continue to defend Democratic President Joe Biden, Kaufman said. Republicans' Parents Matter-focused agenda won resoundingly, with Governor Reynolds winning by 19 points and historic majorities in the legislature. Anderson, the Iowa State University political science professor, cautioned against dismissing the implications of Tuesday's school board elections just because Iowa Republicans has been successful in other recent elections. The school board elections distilled down to what's going on in the schools. State legislative elections are about a whole host of other things as well, Anderson said. I understand their claim that says, yeah, we campaigned on this and we won. But they also campaigned on a host of other things, and voters are making compromises. Voters are making choices, and when it comes to the state legislature, they may have cared about other things more. Elections are about things, and every election is about something different. And you know, voters aren't dumb. They know the difference between what a school board does and what a state legislature does. With consecutive wave elections in the opposite direction, Anderson said it is possible that school board elections will be less partisan again starting in 2025. Iowans want our teachers to feel supported, that we respect what they do, and we trust them, Anderson said, and that they would sort of like to get back to normal. Cedar Falls Utilities Board okays base rate hikes. This is written by Andy Malone. Rates are rising for a second year in a row for Cedar Falls Utilities' thousands of customers as the Board of Trustees sets its 2024 budget. The board unanimously approved the $150.39 million budget Wednesday. That includes the rate adjustments in January to help balance the budget and keep up with rising costs. All types of electric, gas, and water customers will see their overall bills increase on an average by 4.6%, 2.10%, and 9.6% respectively. That includes the commercial and industrial classes. The base rate increase on their own will total about $8 per month more for residential customers, increasing electric, gas, and water bills by $4.20 to $87.88, $1.83 to $56.98, and $2.30 to $29.32 respectively on average if energy and commodity costs stay the same. Gas customers have a commodity charge on their bills that are not impacted by the base rate adjustment, but officials project lower market energy and gas costs will keep the overall utility bill totals low and steady this winter compared to last. Additionally, television and internet subscribers will see a $7 hike to $161.50. Of the $150.39 million in expenditures, more than half is from the electric side of the operation. Capital outlay is projected to reach $50.14 million. Principal and interest payments are $3.35 million from 2015 loans. Operational expenses total $96.27 million, $58.41 million for commodities, and $23.95 million for compensation and benefits for the 215 employees. Of the $50.14 million in capital expenses, $16.39 million will go for work associated with the proposed reciprocating engine electric generating power plant the utility says will position it to provide reliable and affordable power for years to come and require eventually bonding more than $60 million. Sullivan Brothers Plaza dedicated. Annual State of the City Address Highlights Memorial. This is written by Maria Cooper. There's a new anchor in downtown shining a beacon of light on the community veterans. Mayor Quentin Hart and Kelly Sullivan, the granddaughter of Albert Sullivan and grandniece of his four brothers, unveiled the Sullivan Brothers Plaza on Thursday. The plaza, under construction since the year 2021, was dedicated after Hart's State of the City address. Sullivan said, even 80 years later, the family is persevering after the brothers' death, November the 13th, 1942. She said, the week has been very emotional with the plaza dedication, Veterans Day, and the anniversary of the USS Juno's sinking. Although the space commemorates George, Francis, Joseph, Madison, and Albert Sullivan, the plaza is for everyone. The City of Waterloo continues to honor not just the Sullivans, but all veterans, Sullivan said. Please remember that the Sullivans are a symbol. The memorial is designed to follow the shape of a ship deck. A gangplank leads visitors to the center of the ship to view the four two-sided pillars, where one side tells historic stories while the other side offers modern-day reflection. Patches of grass represent waves of the ocean. There are 70 pavers, 69 dark and 1 light, to represent the nearly 700 servicemen who died on the USS Juno. There were 10 survivors. The overall theme of Together was inspired by a quote from the eldest Sullivan brother, George, who said they served on one ship because we stick together. Dean Proctor, the designer of the plaza, said there was no greater honor than to bring such a story to the community. We're not only telling the Sullivan's story, Proctor said, but we should make this memorial relevant to everyone today. The mantra of togetherness started at the beginning of Hart's address, which summed up what Waterloo achieved in the past year. He continued to talk about his 2030 community vision, introduced in the year 2021, which has 8 pillars, including increasing housing, connecting neighborhoods, growing the workforce, improving morale, revamping the Crossroads Center area, enhancing the downtown district, adding sports facilities, and creating a community of opportunity. He touted that Waterloo is on track to reach $150 million in economic development projects, which could bring the new companies new housing, new jobs, and improved quality of life. The city has focused a lot of its time on the goal of redeveloping, renovating, or improving 800 residences by the year 2030. Hart said there are 245 new housing units, 57 new single and multifamily homes, a 180-unit residential complex, and an 8-plex that are newly built or under development. He also said the legal department is working to renovate or replace 20 dilapidated properties and has hired an additional rental inspector to increase housing examinations. The city is also seeing multiple millions of dollars in permits or permitted value from development. The $150 million includes opening up 300 acres near the Waterloo Regional Airport for 6 new industrial buildings, which is estimated to create over 60 new jobs and $8 million in taxable value. In the Crossroads Center area, he reminded the crowd that the city received $20 million from a federal grant to reconstruct LaPorte Road from the frontage road off of U.S. Highway 218 near Mitchell Avenue all the way to the Lost Island Water and Theme Parks. You take that and add the incredible work being done on San Marnin and in this corridor, and you have the beginnings of something special, Hart said. The city also received $2.5 million in state and federal grants to improve traffic safety and operations. Public safety is also increasing and expanding. The Waterloo Police Department is now at full staff, and officers seized about 180 firearms in the past year. Waterloo Fire Rescue is bringing dogs back into the department, as well as dedicating a fourth frontline ambulance and crew on the north end of the city. That revenue will help pay for 8 firefighters and upgrade the emergency medical services equipment and fleet of ambulances. In addition, Hart commended city staff and elected officials for paying off a $272,000 consent decree with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and Iowa Department of Natural Resources after the city was fined over its sanitary sewer operations due to violations of the Federal Clean Water Act in 2015. The decree was a negotiated settlement to avoid litigation in federal court over untreated sewage being released into rivers and streams. Along with paying the penalty, the city had to remain under regulatory oversight while upgrading the sewer system. The city had until the year 2032 to complete these tasks. Apart from working on the city's infrastructure, Hart said he attended 122 events and ribbon cuttings and held over 900 meetings with the public in his office. Hart tied in his Community of Opportunity slogan and the dedication of the Sullivan Brothers Memorial by challenging audience members and viewers to volunteer in the city. In a small way, your sacrifice for the greater good contributes to the quality of life we all benefit from, he said. We need you to join the ranks and serve your community in the spirit of volunteerism we believe this plaza inspires. Rosie the Riveter, Topic of Iowa Book, is the title of our next article. It's the latest from author-historian Linda McCann. This is written by Melody Parker of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and the dateline is Shell Rock. Author and historian Linda McCann said it's surprising where she gets ideas for her books. Her latest book, Rosie the Riveters of Iowa, popped into her head several years ago when her oldest granddaughter dressed up for Halloween as Rosie the Riveter. But I couldn't figure out where to find Iowa's Rosies and just kind of dropped it. Then I was speaking in Mount Pleasant when I overheard a lady say she'd been a Rosie. My ears perked up. We exchanged email addresses and I found out she was part of the American Rosie the Riveter Association. She was able to set me up with people to talk to, and I was on my way, said McCann. She will discuss her book at 6:30 p.m. Wednesday at the Cedar Falls Library. The public may attend. There is no admission fee. Books, $20 each, will be available to purchase by cash or check. When men left the workforce and enlisted in the military during World War II, their wives, girlfriends, mothers, and sisters took their place in America's factories producing munitions, tank, airplanes, and other material. The iconic World War II Rosie the Riveter poster featured a female factory worker in red polka dot bandana flexing her bicep. Women were encouraged to step forward and do their part by going to work in traditionally male jobs, McCann said. She interviewed 35 women who were Rosies and shares their recollections in her book. Women worked in factories, packing plants, canning plants, clothing mills, and more. They worked as riveters, welders, drill press and lathe operators, inspectors, and other jobs. The biggest thing is that every one of these women said, "I didn't do anything special. In Southeast Iowa, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a senior living community and a woman raised her hand and said she'd been a Rosie at the Burlington Ordnance Plant. The lady next to her said she was a Rosie during the war, but didn't want to talk about it." A friend told McCann about her two aunts who worked at Chamberlain Manufacturing Company in Waterloo during World War II. The company employed 350 women in its workforce to produce bombs during the war, including fragmentation, armor piercing, and gas bombs. One day at work, the aunts received a visit from military representatives telling them that their brother had been killed. "That brother was my friend's dad, and she was just 10 days old when he was killed." Iowa played a crucial role in the war effort, with 70 factories boasting military contracts, McCann learned, including John Deere. A January 2, 1944 article in the Courier gave an overview of area workplaces where a battalion of 10,000 men and a regiment of 4,000 women were working well over $600,000 each week to keep the war plant wheels turning. In Waterloo, John Deere employed 498 women and built tank transmissions and aircraft parts. Associated Manufacturing, also in Waterloo, employed 300 women in 1944, building tail fins for 81-millimeter shells, 23-pound fragmentation bombs, and landmine fuses. In her research, McCann learned that World War I had its share of Rosies as well. A group called the Farmettes went to work on farms cultivating vegetables for the home front and military, she said. They were paid 20 cents an hour. The author is passionate about Iowa history. When these generations are gone, history goes with them. Everyone seems to think they don't have a story to tell, but I ask them a few questions, then they realize they do have stories to tell. We need to share our memories with kids, especially the Iowa history part that isn't covered in school, she explained. McCann has written 14 nonfiction history books published by Tandem Publishing in Des Moines, including Prisoners of War in Iowa, Prohibition in Eastern Iowa, and several books on the Civilian Conservation Corps. Her next book will be on polio in Iowa, expected in spring of 2024. The author has additional upcoming presentations at 5 p.m. November the 21st at the Tripoli Library, 6:30 p.m. November 27th at Denver Public Library, and Denver Open House from 1 to 4 p.m. December 2nd at the Denver Public Library. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First, Madeline Joyce Fuller, age 85, of Waterloo, passed away peacefully on the morning of Wednesday, November the 1st, 2023, at Denver Sunset Home in Denver, Iowa. Public visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. on Friday, November the 17th, 2023, at Haggerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Services, West Ridgeway, located at 300 West Ridgeway, Waterloo, Iowa. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, November the 18th, at Cedar Falls Christian Church, 2727 West 4th Street, Cedar Falls, Iowa, with Pastor Dennis Platt officiating. There will also be a one-hour visitation prior to the service on Saturday. Memorial contributions may be directed in Joyce's name to her family, which will be later designated elsewhere. For further information or to leave an online condolence, please visit www.HaggertyWyckoffGarup.com. Haggerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service West Ridgeway is caring for Joyce and her family. Zelma Mae Frickson, age 93, of Cedar Falls, died Tuesday, November the 7th at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. She was born on July 25, 1930 in Waterloo to Edward and Josephine Stanford. Funeral services were held Saturday, November the 11th, 2023 at Lock at Tower Park, 1440 Kimball Avenue, Waterloo, with the visitation on Friday held at the funeral home. Memorials to the family. Cremation to follow services. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralservices.com. Next, Patricia Joanne Treichel, age 73, of Waterloo, died Saturday, November the 11th at Unity Point Allen Hospital. Public visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November the 16th at Haggerty Weichhoff Guerra Funeral Service on South Street. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertyweichhoffguerra.com. Brad Mark Condon, age 73, of Waterloo, passed away Friday, November the 10th at Unity Point Allen Hospital. Mass of Christian burial will be held noon Wednesday, November 15th at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with burial at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Public visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 14th at Haggerty Weichhoff Guerra Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, where there will be a 6:30 vigil service. Visitation also 1 hour prior to the Mass on Wednesday at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Sunrise Exchange Club Zoo or directed to family for memorial. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertyweichhoffguerra.com. John Martin Schrum died Saturday, November 11, 2023 at UPH/Allen Hospital. His funeral service will be 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, November the 15th, 2023 at Emmanuel Lutheran Church of Cedar Falls, with visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday at Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home of Cedar Falls. Entombment will follow at Garden of Memories Cemetery in Waterloo. Full obituary can be found at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Gloria A. Lewis, age 91, of Jessup, Iowa, died Thursday, November 9, 2023, at Unity Point Health Allen Memorial Hospital following an accidental fall in Jessup. Public visitation will be 3 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, November the 15th, 2023, at the White Funeral Home in Jessup. Private graveside ceremonies will be Thursday, November the 16th, 2023, at Cedar Crest Cemetery in Jessup. Memorials may be directed to the family. Condolences may be placed at www.white-mounthope.com. White Funeral Home, Jessup, is in charge of the arrangements. Jennifer Lynn Welch Doherty passed away unexpectedly and peacefully at home on November the 8th, 2023. As Jennifer was not one for formalities, no funeral will be held. Instead, a celebration of life will be held December 16th, 2023 at 2 p.m. at Front Row, 9956 Swanson Boulevard in Clive, Iowa. Paul Thomas Tom Gallagher, age 72, of LaPorte City, passed away November the 9th. Funeral services Wednesday, November 15th at 11 a.m. Van Steenhuis Tehen Funeral Home, 1212 First Avenue, Vinton. Interment, Maplewood Cemetery. Colleen A. Jacob, age 72, of Denver, Iowa, passed away at home on November the 7th. Graveside services will be held at a later date in Oakland Cemetery, Janesville. Arrangements, Kaiser Corson Funeral Home. Dr. Stephen A. Mong, age 72, of Waterloo, died Sunday, November the 5th, 2023, due to complications of colon cancer. A memorial gathering will be from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, November 19th, at Lock at Tower Park, 4140 Kimball Avenue, Waterloo. Memorials are directed to Cedar Valley Hospice or Cedar Bend Humane Society. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralservices.com. And Nellie E. Hart, age 105, of Waterloo, died Saturday, November 11th, 2023, at North Crest Specialty Care. Graveside services Wednesday, November the 15th, at 11 a.m., Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery, 3430 West 4th Street. Arrangements by Lock on 4th, Lock Funeral Services. Amanda Sue Newburn, born March 20th, 1989, was welcomed to heaven on Friday, November the 30th, 2023, by her mom, dad, grandparents, and other relatives. She lived in Wabasha for the past 17 years, before that in Onalaska, Wisconsin, and her forever hometown of Cedar Falls, Iowa. Funeral services will be 11:30 a.m. Wednesday, November the 15th at Faith Lutheran Church, Wabasha, Minnesota, with Pastor Dave Knox officiating. Interment will be 1 p.m. Thursday, November 16th at Eastside Cemetery, Elkader, Iowa. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 14th at Abbott Funeral Home, Wabasha, and beginning at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday at the church. Services entrusted to Abbott Funeral Home and Crematory, Wabasha, Minnesota. Words of sympathy or remembrance may be left at www.abbottfh.com. Now we'll move on to sports, and our top story is entitled Iowa, Clark, Too Much for Panthers. Superstar guard records triple-double in 94-53 Hawkeye win. Iowa flexed its women's basketball superiority, dominating Northern Iowa 94-53 in front of a sold-out McLeod Center crowd of 6,790 on Sunday. The number 3 Hawkeyes held the Panthers to an abysmal 25% field goal percentage and 2 of 19 from three-point range. UNI head coach Tanya Warren described the loss as one of those days. "We defended well enough," Warren said, "but eventually it is going to strain your defense. We got good shots. We got good looks. I have no excuse as to why we shot the basketball as poorly as we did, other than we were not ready for this stage yet. We will get ready, but this moment might have been too big for us. This team is better than that. We will learn from this game, and if we can get ourselves healthy, we feel like we have a really good team." Iowa head coach Lisa Bluter highlighted the Hawkeyes' three-point defense following the win, particularly due to the Panthers' usually highly efficient deep-range shooting. "We talked a lot about running people off the line and making sure we did not give up open threes," Bluter said. "That, I think, was big for us." The Panthers sorely missed the scoring of floor general Maya McDermott, who played 10 minutes in the first half before sitting out the entirety of the second half. Warren did not expand on the nature of McDermott's injury and only provided a possibly in response to a question asking whether the Panthers knew about the injury before tip-off. In relief of McDermott, true sophomore Taryn Wharton stepped up, playing a career-high 26 minutes. Wharton spent the majority of her time on the defensive end, serving as the primary defender on reigning Naismith Player of the Year, Caitlin Clark. "Caitlin Clark is the best player in the country," Warren said. "You are not going to stop her. You are not going to contain her. You just have to try to make things tough for her. I thought, for the most part, Taryn did a terrific job." "It was definitely a challenge," Wharton said. "I am always up for a challenge, so it was a lot of fun to do that." The Hawkeyes took advantage of the Panthers' shooting woes throughout Sunday's contest, building a 20-11 lead in the first quarter. Back-to-back threes from Caitlin Clark at 6:07 to play in the first and Gabby Marshall with 5:40 to go pushed the Iowa lead to double figures, 17-5. UNI rallied, however, holding Iowa scoreless for the final 4 minutes and 13 seconds of the first quarter, but failed to fully capitalize on the Hawkeyes' dry spell, managing just 4 points of their own over the same stretch. The Panthers' shooting woes continued into the second quarter as the Panthers finished the first half of action with an abysmal 20% shooting percentage from the field and an even worse 1 from 8 from deep. Their struggles extended to the free throw line, where UNI hit 10 of 16 free throw attempts, 6.5% below its 2022-2023 season average. While UNI continued to struggle in the second quarter, Iowa's shooting percentage rose to 40.6% as the Hawkeyes connected on 6 of their 13 field goal attempts to take a 40-25 lead into the break. After 20 minutes of action, Clark led all scorers with 13 points, connecting on 37.5% of her field goal attempts, but 6 of 7 free throws. Grace Buffelli led the Panthers with 7 points despite sitting out all but 9 seconds of the second quarter with 2 fouls. Anytime you can put their best player on the bench, that is the easiest way to guard them, Bluter said. We talk about that all the time with our team. If somebody is hard to guard, we put them on the bench. Warren said the 50 total fouls called in the game prevented either team from getting into a rhythm, a sentiment shared by Bluter, but thought UNI needed to do a better job adjusting to the officiating. Iowa came out of the break scorching the Nets, hitting 4 of its first 5 shots, including a pair of triples, to push its advantage to 21 within the first 3 minutes of action, forcing UNI to take an early timeout with 6:43 remaining in the third quarter. The timeout did little to stem Iowa's offensive onslaught as the Hawkeyes took a 71-45 lead into the fourth quarter after connecting on 6 triples in the third while UNI managed just 5 field goals. Iowa outscored UNI 19-12 in the final frame as Clark locked up her 12th career triple-double, leading the Hawkeyes with 24 points, 11 assists, and 10 rebounds. Clark's 24-point outing moved the senior guard past Megan Gustafson as the all-time scoring leader in Iowa history, as she now has 2,813 career points. Bluter described the moment as an amazing accomplishment as she praised her superstar guard. To do it this early in her career is absolutely amazing, Bluter said. I am really proud of her and incredibly thankful. It is so gratifying because Caitlin chose to come to the University of Iowa when she could have went anywhere in the country. I am so proud she took a chance with us. Of breaking the record, Clark said the moment and all that came with it spoke to the culture in Iowa City. It is special getting to do it with this group, Clark said. Megan reached out to me last night and basically just told me, go break it. You deserve this. I think that speaks to the culture Coach Bluter has built here. She develops really great players, but also people that want to see other people succeed. Gabby Marshall added 17 points, and Hannah Stolke recorded 16 points with 7 rebounds. Riley Wright led the Panthers with 14 points and 7 rebounds. Buffelli finished with 11 and 6. Here's an article from columnist Jim Nelson, and it's entitled, UNI Admins Got It Right with Choice of McLeod. Planning? A+. Execution? A+. Atmosphere? A++. In the weeks leading up to Sunday's Northern Iowa women's basketball game against the number 3 Iowa, soon to be number 1, at the McLeod Center in Cedar Falls, I was involved in a lot of lively debate about the location of the game. Did UNI sell itself short by keeping the game in the McLeod Center? Why wasn't the game moved to the Unidome, where potentially thousands of more tickets could have been sold? It was a good debate. At first, I was pro-Unidome. I was biased in that opinion because I was part of the 22,797 fans that witnessed the January 1990 UNI men's team upset victory over Iowa. I still rank that as one of my top 5 sporting experiences in my lifetime. But UNI's administration made the right call. While the final score, a 53 win for the Hawkeyes behind a triple-double of 24 points, 11 assists, and 10 rebounds from superstar Caitlin Clark dampened the mood, I would find it hard to argue it wasn't a successful day. I certainly believe UNI could have put at least 15,000 backsides into seats at the Dome had it chosen to do so, but in the end, the intimate crowd of 6,790 at the McLeod made for a fantastic atmosphere. I think logistically, the costs of remaking the Dome into a basketball facility for one game on the heels of the high school football playoffs finishing after 10 p.m. Saturday had to have been deemed cost prohibitive. 1, the playoffs are a moneymaker for UNI. 2, the turnaround for a 2 p.m. game the next day, yes, possible, but could it have been done to the standards that you and I met Sunday? It would have been hard. It would have been a hard ask. As it turns out, it wasn't the pseudo-Iowa home game a lot of people were expecting. Yes, there was a fair share of Hawkeye fans, but you and I fans held the majority. Great atmosphere, Coach Tanya Warren said. I want to thank my administration. I thought they did a terrific job. Panther fans, they showed up, and I apologize for the performance. I hope they will continue to come back. This game in no way defines our team. This team is better from that, and we will learn from this game. The student section brought it from the start. I do not approve of every comment they directed at the Iowa players and coaches or the officials, but there was some good banter even in heckling the Hawkeye cheerleaders. As Iowa's cheer group walked onto the McLeod Center floor, one student screamed, "Go back to Iowa City and continue to live off Daddy's checks," which I found super humorous because I have a high school senior who does hold multiple jobs, but is going to go to school in Iowa City next fall and live off his dad and mom's checks, or as he likes to put it, be sponsored. And there definitely were a ton of Clark fans. The entrance to the locker rooms from the competition floor was lined with many, many young girls, and Clark obliged by signing for a good 15 minutes after the game. She is the best ever to put it on, and I don't know if we will see another one like her in my lifetime, Warren said. Iowa coach Lisa Bluder, a former Panther herself, complimented the crowd and made fun of herself at the same time. That was something that wouldn't happen when I was here, Bluder laughed. We played in the dome. That was hard to fill that thing out. Yeah, it was pretty cool. You come back to your former place and you always want to do well, right? Representing well, and I thought we did that today. Yep, it was a pretty cool day. In other sports news, third-ranked Wartburg College, the American Rivers Conference champions, will host Illinois College in an NCAA Division III first-round playoff game Saturday at noon at Walston Hoover Stadium. This will be the first meeting between the Knights and the Blue Boys, who won the Midwest Conference title and an automatic bid into the playoff field. Wartburg will be making its 16th playoff appearance. Illinois College will enter the game on an 8-game win streak, with their lone loss coming against Lake Forest on September the 9th. The winner will advance to play the winner of Whitworth or Chapman on November the 25th. In cross country, Wartburg College's Christopher Collette captured the Midwest Regional title Saturday for the second consecutive season on the Knights' home course. Collette crossed the finish line in 24 minutes, 9.7 seconds to set the course record as he helped Wartburg finish second overall behind North Central College. Jack Kinzer took 10th in 24:38.2, and Jacob Green was 11th in 24:38.4. Collette and Green's times were both season bests. The Wartburg men earned an at-large berth into the NCAA field for the championships, which take place in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Saturday. Behind individual champion Lexi Brown, the Wartburg women won the regional title with 37 points as the Knights had four runners finish in the top seven. Brown crossed in 20 minutes, 51.6 seconds, a new course record, with Shaylin Hostiger fourth in 21:08.3, Aubie Fisher fifth, 21:10.6, and Ellie Meyer seventh, 21:23.9. Six of Wartburg's seven runners set personal best times in the race. Brown's individual victory was the first for the Knights since 2018. In USHL hockey, Tri-City scored twice in the final 7 minutes and 52 seconds, including getting the game winner on a shorthanded tally with 4:41 left to rally past the Waterloo Blackhawks and complete a weekend sweep Saturday. Ryan Smith scored shorthanded to provide the Storm the game winner. Former Blackhawk Jake Rossi tied the game with 7:52 left in the game, a power play tally. Waterloo took a 2-1 lead in the second period as Jake Delaney and Griffin Erdman each scored. After Tri-City tied it in the third, Delaney scored again on assists from Erdman and John Mustard, a power play goal with 10:20 left in the game. Tri-City won Friday's game 6-2. Erdman had a goal and an assist for the Blackhawks, and Grady Deering also scored. Waterloo returns to action Friday in Dubuque and Saturday in Des Moines at Young Arena. And in college wrestling, six Northern Iowa wrestlers claimed titles Saturday at the Grandview Open. Top-ranked Parker Kekeson rolled to the crown at 184 with four bonus wins. He topped Isaiah Lulin of Grandview 16-5 in the finals. Kekeson finished the tournament with two major decisions, a technical fall and a pin. R.J. Weston captured the 157-pound crown, beating Grandview's Tanner Abbas 11-1 in the finals. Among his five wins Saturday was a 10-4 win over returning NCAA qualifier Jason Crazer of Iowa State in the second round. In the freshman division, Bowen Downey and Brandon Pays each went 4-0 and shared the 125-pound title. Izzy Moreno registered four pins and six bonus point wins to win at 165. Nix Fox also scored four pins and five victories to win at 174, and C.J. Walrath had five bonus point victories, including three technical falls, while winning at 184. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you.